Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Today I'm sat in Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, at the University Football Stadium. It's a magnificent setting, and I'm sitting here with an old friend, Andy Blow. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, Simon. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's a 5,000 miles from home, and here we are living the dream.
Exactly. It's a beautiful day out there as well.
Yeah, just looking up at the mountains. You run up one of those this morning, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Took the boys out for a little stroll for breakfast. Earned our burritos.
What was the name of the peak you went up then?
Bear Peak.
Height?
2,500, I think.
Oh, breathing a bit difficult up there then.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah. Seeing stars on the way down, but it was worth it.
Yeah. So, listen, did you see 220 magazine resurrected that whole conversation between me and you? Yeah. Should you do a long run or shouldn't you?
Yeah, I saw that. Good question. I still think I'm right.
Well, you would do. That's just your black way of thinking at it, yeah, versus my white way of thinking of,
indeed,
you shouldn't do a long run. And it reminded me when I was listening to your presentation yesterday about this binary thinking that a lot of people like to engage in, you know, yeah, almost like tribalism, you called it. Just recap some of the examples you gave of black versus white thinking.
Well, I think it's becoming a pet peeve of mine in the sports science world, in the coaching world, really, of seeing all these questions that athletes want to know the answers to, and people presenting them with either or binary options. You know, the classic one is always carbohydrates or fats. You know, yeah, is it, should you eat high carb or should you eat low carb, high fat? And that creates these tribal mentalities between people who they align with whatever belief they feel fits with their pre-existing ideas. And then everything that they do doubles down on basically promoting that idea and rubbishing any other contradictory idea.
So in your presentation yesterday, you showed a picture of Ali and another boxer, yeah, nose to nose. Was that Foreman or Frazier?
Frazier, I think.
Right. So, and of course, if you went to a boxing match, you were either one or the other. There, yeah, weren't many neutrals in those days, were there? Yeah. And it's the same as if you go to football and you're either Manchester United or Liverpool. You can't really go to one of those partisan games,
no,
and be a neutral bystander because everybody thinks you must be us or them. We did a presentation at a 220 expo. Down, yeah, at the cycling,
oh, the
velodrome in, yeah, London, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we build it like a boxing match,
yeah,
if you remember.
I do, yeah.
And we had a whole load of subjects where it was me versus you, barefoot versus shod,
yeah,
long run versus no long run,
yeah,
fats versus carbohydrates.
Yeah.
What was it? Strength training versus no strength training.
Yeah.
And all of those things. And at the end, we said to people, it depends, which frustrates the hell, yeah, out of athletes, doesn't it?
It does.
Coaches say it depends because it does.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest take-home I was trying to present in my talk yesterday was actually that I was talking obviously more specifically about the topic of hydration, because that's become quite polarised with this idea of drink to a thirst or drink to plan. Do you take electrolytes or do you not take electrolytes? Mm. And it's a very important concept to get across to people, that quite often where you see these two apparently contradictory ideas, the truth for any individual circumstance can be at one end or the other, actually, but more often than not is going to be somewhere in the middle.
Mm.
So I was using some examples yesterday of saying, you know, should we drink to a plan if we're doing an endurance event?
Yeah.
And there's no right or wrong answer to that, by the way, but we presented some scenarios with people who are racing long distance races in the heat, who are novices, who are nervous about the event, and we polled the room, didn't we, and found that, you know, basically the consensus was that if you're doing a long race, if it's hot, if you're a novice, if you've not got experience to draw on, then having some kind of hydration plan, or at least an outline of a plan to start to stick to, is probably a very good idea. as compared with, you know, a way more experienced athlete, and particularly if you're out there racing in the cold, you may be able to just rely on instincts.
Well, here's a good example, because you said that the reason you started all of this precision hydration stuff was because you were constantly ending up in the med tent, getting cramps and suffering in races, or not even able to finish. And when you did a test which showed the concentration of salt in your sweat, it was really high.
Yeah.
You did, I mean, I did one of the first tests with you. You came to Leeds, didn't you, and tested myself and a few people I know. And my salt concentration is actually quite low.
Yeah.
And that's sort of correlates with what happens to me in races. Mm. I very rarely get cramps.
Yeah.
I don't have quite as much of those salty deposits you see on dark clothing. Mm. But we're looking out over this stadium now. It's a beautiful sunny day. If we get out there, it's probably going to be 85, yeah. 90 out in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You just said you ran up to 2,500 metres this morning.
Yeah.
So you've come from the UK. You're adjusting to a time zone. We're at altitude, and you've gone up to an even higher altitude this morning. It's going to be hot up there, even though you went early in the morning.
Mm.
And you burned through a lot of salt.
Yeah.
So if you went home, running in Bournemouth, when you get home in October, it's going to be much cooler.
Yeah.
Your salt requirements for that run.
Oh, it'd be totally different,
wouldn't they? Yeah, like so there's a good example of it depends, even for somebody like you. And again, me and you running up that mountain this morning would have required a different hydration strategy.
Definitely. I mean, I used one of our strongest electrolyte drinks this morning before I went up there, because I wasn't going to carry a bottle with me to the top because that's extra weight. So I had a good drink before I went. And I would not normally, you know, I wouldn't do that before I go out and do an hour's run at home. But this morning I was prepared, and I did sweat an absolute ton this morning. You're right. I got back to the car and my hat was drenched. It was dripping off me. And I came back and I had the saltiest burrito for breakfast, and it tasted fantastic because my body needed it.
Yeah. And that's another good point there is you can get salt. You don't need exogenous salt, do you? As in a supplement, you can just put a little bit of sea salt on your food, either while you're cooking it or.
Yeah, or while you're eating. A lot of the time in training, that's usually good enough. I think where supplementation becomes a bit more interesting is obviously during long events when you're not going to stop and have chips. You're going to, you know, you want to drink what's in your bottles or eat what's in your pockets. But yeah, you're right. The requirements between two different people are vastly different. And, you know, going back to that initial point about what this creates, if everyone looks at things through the lens of their own experience, it can create very contradictory viewpoints. So I look at it through my experience, and I was guilty of this a number of years ago when my lens on this was, look, the more salt and fluid I seem to take during these long distance events, the better my performance got. And I certainly, when I was a lot younger, I was guilty of imposing that view on everyone. It's like, well, this is how much salt I take, so try that. And I need a really, really high amount. And I've since met athletes that virtually require none.
Mm-hmm.
But I've met athletes every step of the spectrum in between as well. So what we're trying to do now is help people figure out where they are. And the first step to that, the reason I talked about it without talking in technical detail yesterday, is awareness. Because I think otherwise people, judging from the emails we get into precision hydration and the questions we get on social media, people are confused because they see these black and white contradictory things about, do I need electrolytes or not? Should I drink X amount or, you know, whatever? And they think there's a definitive answer that they've just got to uncover.
It's very difficult, isn't it, for somebody with, you know, I mean, most triathletes are reasonably knowledgeable, but their knowledge is limited. It's not the same depth of scientific knowledge that you have or somebody like Tim Noakes. And I know you referenced Tim Noakes in your presentations and there's articles on your website about this whole Tim Noakes idea that one should drink to thirst in response to the one should drink as much water as possible, which was promoted by somebody else who had something to gain, which was the sort of companies that are producing sports drinks. He was railing against the idea, but it took it from one extreme to another.
Mm.
And I think as part of your presentation, you were saying, you know, there are times and places, short distance races, cooler climates when you can drink to thirst.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of times when that's what you can do, really. And it's good to rely on your thirst instincts to an extent. And it's good to drink predominantly water a lot of the time, because unless you're engaging in very extreme activity, which we do, you know, we see some athletes do. There's triathletes here in Boulder that I've been chatting to this week are in the big build up to Kona, who are easily smashing out 25, 30 hours a week. And for those guys, a more proactive approach to their hydration is necessary if they're going to get up every day day in, day out and perform and recover. But for the vast majority of people, and certainly for myself, you know, I've got a sports drink now that we've made ourselves, the 1500 milligram precision hydration, which is the perfect drink for me when I'm absolutely smashing it and doing big events or big, but I drink it fairly sparingly these days because most of the time I'm doing 4 or 5 hours training a week, so I don't need it.
I have to confess that over the last few years I've moved away from any sort of supplementation. I get a little bit of cordial and I get some sea salt, a thumb and finger full of sea salt, and I just sprinkle it into my bottle. There's no science behind that. I couldn't tell you what concentration of salt it is. When we were cycling through Italy in the summer, we were riding in the mountains, so we were at altitude similar to what we're talking about. And most days we were topping 2,500, 3,000 metres. We were in the middle of that heat wave that they had in southern Europe, so I would say that the temperature out in the open was well into the high 30s, low 40s. So, you know.
Seriously hot.
Yeah, seriously hot. And you're burning through the water. Every morning I'd make my little drink, little bit of orange juice, some salt. And one of the girls that was sitting at the breakfast table said, what's your blood pressure like, Simon? She said, you seem to have an awful lot of salt through the day. And I'm saying, yeah, but have you not noticed how much we're sweating, Sarah? It's, you know, you need to be managing that. And because if all you're doing is drinking water, then you end up in that hypernatremic state that you mentioned.
Yeah, if you dilute your body down. So adding a little bit of salt is often a good thing if you're doing hours and hours of sweating. And it's a bit like the whole thing about salt and blood pressure is an interesting one because we get a lot of questions about that. I did some research and I wrote a pretty detailed blog about it not long ago to answer some of those questions. But fundamentally, I think what it boils down to is that, you know, if you're an athlete sweating a lot and you're adding some extra salt to your diet or taking in some extra sodium in your sports drinks, which is roughly in line with what your sweat output is, then it's a zero sum gain. You know, you're replacing what you're losing, and that's what you're aiming to do. It helps keep your body in homeostatic balance. If, on the other hand, you're smashing sports drinks and salting your food and going crazy with the salt shaker when you're not training hard and when you're not, that's very likely to be a negative thing. In the same way that it is if you're, you know, we could sort of pull in the carbohydrate thing there. You know, my sort of take on the carbohydrate and fat debate is largely that I came up in an era, probably same as you, where carbohydrate was the only thing that was talked about. It was the only thing athletes should eat. And I ate a very high carb diet.
I remember getting copies of Triathlete magazine, so the American publication, which then they did a British version. And Mrs. T's pierogies, so those little, ravioli?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, like little pockets of pasta. With different fillings in them. They were sponsoring the Chicago Triathlon. Yeah. Mrs. T's, wasn't it? Yeah. Chicago Triathlon. Every week there'd be those Chef Carbo. Do you remember him in 220? Yeah. He used to do his best pasta dish for the week. I'd have bread and cereal for my breakfast. I've had sandwiches for my lunch. And in the evening, I'd be having rice or pasta. And when I think about the amount of carbohydrate, because I was trying to hit that 60 to 70%. Of your total calorific intake for the day as carbohydrates.
And the interesting thing is, you know, when you're training really, really hard, because you'll have done big, big weeks on training camps, and I had periods in my life when I was training for in excess of 20 hours a week routinely, and I would eat a lot of carbohydrates because you needed them, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's it's always possible to eat too much, you know, but when you're doing that much training, I sat down and had lunch with a pro triathlete here the other day, and you know, he weighs like probably got 5 to 10% lower body fat than I've got, and he sat there and ate the biggest pile of carbohydrates, but he'd been out that morning and run for 3 hours.
And if he's got another session to do later on in the day, which is quite likely, then you're not only catching up, you're preparing for the next session and also for remainder in the week. And I think this is where this polarized argument for all of those examples we gave falls down a bit, because in an end of season recovery phase, when he's maybe doing an hour a day just to tick over, he wouldn't need to be eating like that.
And I've found that I can manage my own weight, body composition or whatever a lot more easily these days, even though I'm a bit older and I train a bit less, just by cycling carbohydrates around training a bit more. So I'll eat a much lower carbohydrate diet just by cutting out some of the extra stuff, and maybe, you know, eating less carbohydrate based breakfasts and things like that. on days when I'm not training or during phases when I'm not training, and it feels better. It feels healthier and more right to me.
So Dan Plews, Dr. Dan Plews, yeah. A guy that we both know well, he's an extremely good triathlete. In fact, he's the best age group Ironman triathlete in the world, really, isn't he? Yeah. He set the record in Kona last year.
Absolutely amazing.
8:24. Professor Paul Larson, who was at this conference last year, and they're big advocates of the low-carb, high-fat approach. However, even they would admit that at times when you're doing high-intensity training or very high volume, you have to cycle those carbohydrates in. It's not a fixed prescription.
Mm.
It's got to be fluid.
Yeah.
And again, I think there's a tendency to become really evangelical about a particular style of something and not be swayed from that. And that's when I think it starts to go wrong for people who are using it, when they don't perhaps have the same depth of knowledge that you or Dan or Paul do.
They don't. What gets lost is the nuance of it, because that takes, if you're going to engage with the nuance of a complex subject, you've got to spend a lot of time reading about it, thinking about it, gathering and synthesizing a lot of information about it. And most people are either don't have the time or inclination, or are not equipped to do that on all subjects. You know, there's plenty of, I have my little niche subjects that I'm interested in and read about and probably have a good appreciation of the nuance about, but there'll be other walks of life and other areas of life where I'm just being fed the simplistic party line information and probably not, you know, grasping the full subject at all.
I think if I jump in here from a coach's perspective, that's what coaches can bring to the relationship with an athlete, is that filter between all of the information out there. Perhaps the ability to, as one of our other presenters yesterday, Christy Ashwanden, talked about in terms of the research, is good research versus bad research.
Yeah.
What's important. So, you know, you could spend a couple of hours a day worrying about the salt concentration you need in your bottle of water for a 1 hour run. But if you're only getting 4 hours sleep a night, that's probably a more important thing to fix.
100%.
So it's what are the priorities. How do these nuances affect you and your training at different times of the year, but also different times of your life? You know, I know you talked about salt requirements probably don't change, but things like carbohydrate requirements do change as you get older. There's a lot of evidence that carbohydrates less tolerated in older athletes. Yeah, so things need to, you need to look at things there. And also you and I and Dan, we have access to the experts. We know who they are. We know who the people we can trust that do good science versus pseudoscience. And so I know for subjects that are outside your comfort zone, you would know immediately who to go to get the right information, which is also very important.
Yeah, I would definitely say that I rely a lot on my network these days of trusted people to try and get a steer on certain things. And I think I've probably become less forthright in my outward opinions on subjects where I'm less qualified to speak. When I was younger, I had experience of doing certain things and I was very happy to proclaim that when I'd found something that worked for me, that was the way to do it. I look back at some of the articles I used to write for 220 and I wrote for them for many, many years. And I think I still think I did a really good job a lot of the time and certainly enjoyed doing it and got good feedback. But there were definitely a few things which I probably said in some of my articles, which I look back and think I didn't really consider the individualization of something. It was very much seen through the lens. And you know, you're obviously very coaching focused. I remember one example for me when I was training for Ironman UK for a number of years in a row, like really trying to maximize my performance there, really trying to work on my swimming. And I was coaching a swimming group at the same time. And so I was very hell bent on progression and building the mileage, building the intensity, doing lots of very structured sets, lots of time, 20 minute swims to assess where people were. And I basically sort of inflicted this regime on all these people because I assumed that, like me, they wanted to, what they came to swimming on a Saturday morning to do was to improve and get better and go faster. I now realize when I look back that now I swim nowadays with a group on a regular basis, and I swim mainly for fun and social and a little bit to stay fit and improve my, well, not even improve my performance, just hang on to a bit of performance. And if a young, you know, 22 year old or whatever, 25 year old came along and started telling me to do T20 swims and I would not enjoy that. And it's sort of, but back then I couldn't understand why some people in that swim squad did not like what I was doing and kick back against it. And it's so different. You know, I'll look at it with 20 years later and think a little bit cringe. I should have maybe looked at it from someone else's perspective, I guess.
I think that's something that comes with age and experience, though, isn't it? You mellow a bit in your opinions. You're exposed to different coaching methodologies. You know, we both know the same people who we respect and place on the same pedestal as you know, amazing coaches. I talk about Chris Jones a lot, and I know that you've got a great deal of respect for him. When you hang around people like Chris and Malcolm Brown, who've got a sage-like view of the world, they've coached at the highest level, they're in the latter stage of the coaching life, and everything is that it depends, which, as I said earlier, it's incredibly frustrating for athletes who come to you with a question. Everybody wants an answer, don't they? And they want that polarised answer. Yeah. No, you don't. You need salt. Yes, you do need salt. And we will respond with, well, it depends, because as we've just discussed, there are numerous situations for one individual where the prescription for a particular type of approach will change.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's what comes with age, is you become less opinionated, less evangelical. You're willing to look at things that you might have sort of railed against you when you were young and go, well, actually, maybe there's a case for that in certain circumstances.
I think what's also interesting, you mentioned it a few minutes ago about this, the coach acting as a filter. I think on the almost in contradiction to what we've been saying, I think there are times when the answer to questions can be very vague and it depends. But sometimes you'll have an athlete come to you with, and I've had this immediately recently before a World Championship event, an athlete came to me with some very specific questions about what they should do with their hydration, nutrition going into the event. And rather than give them all the it depends variables and this and that, what I could tell that they needed at that point in time was a relatively definitive answer, because they had a lot going on in their head and in preparation for this race. And I took the view that actually the best thing to do here I'd already worked with this athlete before, and so I had a handle on what they were doing. I asked them to say, what are you planning on doing, hydration and nutrition? They told me it was a pretty good plan. We made a couple of minor tweaks, and I said to them, I think you should listen to your body a bit, but that's what you should stick to. And we kept it really, now there was probably 5 to 10 different ways we could have attacked that situation. But at that point in time, being definitive and giving them the confidence in what they were doing seemed like the more important thing to do than give them the whole spiel about all the variation.
Yeah.
And what do you think about that? Because what you don't want in certain situations is to confuse athletes to the point that you paralyze them.
I think that that comes with experience as well, of learning how to deal with each situation and having more ways of solving problems in your toolbox.
Yeah.
And I think that's what coaching is really all about, is problem solving for people. We have the information and the knowledge and the experience to draw upon. And in that situation, rather than having to think about it, you were able to come up with an immediate solution. Is actually, this guy doesn't need confusing. Maybe that's a discussion for afterwards. But right now, he just needs some certainty. He needs to go away without any doubt in his mind.
100%.
With one less question in his head rather than 5 more. Mm. And he's trusting you as the expert. If you say, right, this is what you should do, he's going to go, right, oh, Andy's told me now. So that's it, I'm happy.
Box it off, yeah. And I felt that actually for this particular individual in the race circumstance, then hydration was important, but it wasn't going to be the defining factor. Mm. The defining factor for this race was more likely to be tactical. And so, and they were, you know, seemed to have good handle on that. So yeah, it was about putting the nutrition and hydration conversation to bed pretty quickly. So there wasn't a load of anxiety around that for the race.
So let's draw this part of the conversation to a close then. We came up with lots of subjects that we could have talked about. I think one of the ideas was that we were going to build this as a boxing match, you know, like a Rocky style thing, you versus me, black versus white, good versus evil. Rambo, what was his name? The Sylvester Stallone character versus Drago, was it?
Oh yeah, Ivan Drago and Rocky. Yeah.
Rocky, and that was sort of like communism versus the free world, wasn't it? And all of that sort of stuff. But those subjects were barefoot running versus shod.
Yeah.
Case for each. I think when we did the velodrome talk, I was on the barefoot running thing because I'd sort of jumped on that.
I saw you kicking around in your Vibrams,
Yeah, you did. And I still wear them for walking around, and I still believe that they strengthen my feet to the point and my motion in my feet, mobility to the point where I could just ditch orthotics. And looking at that beautiful grass-watered pitch out there,
yeah.
I might do some running drills
yeah.
and some strides, but that's about all I would do.
Yeah.
In fact, now I'm wearing Hokas to running, so I've gone
yeah,
from...
You've got both, yeah.
I've had three knee operations, yeah. I've got not much cartilage left, so I need to cushion, provide a bit of extra cushioning. But there's an example. I can run in more racing flat-type things, probably not the sort of things you're used to wearing, but yeah. I can run in those. And I feel like I move faster and I do intervals on the grass. But if I'm doing a long trail run, definitely if I'm running on pavement or tarmac, I'd wear some more cushioning.
Yeah, I mix my shoes up these days. I run in some very thin, light trail running shoes for some of the time, but mostly when I'm running shorter, faster, flat type stuff. When I'm running in the hills or when I'm running longer distances on the road, I've got, they're not Hokas, they're like a Brooks shoe, but a very,
yeah.
very sort of deeply cushioned, really wide, stable shoe, because I've had knee surgery as well. And frankly, it feels better on my joints.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it'd be great running up that mountain, wouldn't it? You're on top of the world, literally. There's a sunset, you feel great. And then the next day you can hardly walk because yeah. you've done 45 minutes of downhill yeah. running at a steep incline.
Well, we were nearly late for the conference today, so I did sprint down the hill for 40 minutes. So I've already got the, it's only a few hours ago, I've got the DOMS kicking in. So
yeah.
I think that's going to be the case.
But that whole thing about cushioning, about looking after your knees, and about, actually, I think it was Mark Lathwaite, who's another coach, does a lot of, based in the Northwest, does a lot of fell running, mountain running. He talked about having different shoes because he felt that if you wear deeply cushioned shoes all the time, you lose that muscle tone in the quads.
Agreed. Yeah. No, I think that's a big reason why I change it up is
yeah.
I think you get repetitive sort of use injuries when you don't change those variables, especially in running. So I've got shoes. The big variable that not so many people talk about in shoes, actually, for me, that's most important, rather than cushioning per se, is the heel to toe drop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because for me, I get a lot of tight calves and Achilles niggles. And I've got a pair of Salomon Speedcross shoes, which have a huge stack on the heel. I think it's 12 millimeter difference.
Yeah, that's the ramp that they talk about, isn't it? Between the forefoot and the rear foot. Yeah.
And that would be that elevation of your heel to your toes. Now, I don't run in those all the time because I feel like you're not using the full range of motion in your calf. And I think you're more predisposed then to more calf problems. So I run in some Innovates as well that are flat, that are virtually, I think, 2 or 3 millimeters drop. But I'll mix it up. But if I've got tight calves or I'm feeling like I've got to look after my Achilles tendons, then I've got a pair of road shoes. I can't remember which ones they are now, but they've got a big heel stack, and these Salomon Speedcross ones that are a big stack, because I'll go out running in those and it just takes the pressure off.
What was quite interesting, I went to the strength and conditioning workshop here with Jess Elliott, and we were talking about strength training. And you know, that's one of my background subjects. And a lot of athletes that strength train regularly will use the same exercises all the time, because from a bodybuilding perspective, you can see if you're doing more curls or more bench press, you know, learn to be efficient and effective in those movements. But her take on it is that you don't want the body to adapt like that and get used to stuff. You want to keep changing things up. So in the same way you change your shoes, one day you might do power cleans.
Yeah.
With a bar. The next day you might do cleans with a kettlebells.
Yeah.
Just a different type of movement. The next day you might do squats, but they'd be front squats, and then you do back squats, and then you might do super slow descent, so eccentric phase, really good for downhill running. But then the next day you might do speed squats. So you're always you're never letting the body settle.
Yeah.
And that means that it actually gets a much greater range of opportunity and use. Similar to your shoe analogy there.
I think that's good if you're building resilience, isn't it?
The resilience, and that's something that perhaps is overlooked in athletes, is that if you're not resilient to stuff through variation, that's when injuries occur, because of that repetitive use.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, though, to put the other perspective on that as well, the opposite is probably true if you're building very specific strength, where what you're trying to do is adapt to the same stress the whole time.
Yeah.
If you are at the extreme, if you're a powerlifter looking to improve your squat, squatting with kettlebells may not be the answer, because you want the high degree of specific overload. But that's a totally different application.
It is. And I always think that whilst I think that strength training is a priority year round because it helps build that resilience and sort of can help you avoid injury. And that, as we both know, consistency is sort of like the number one indicator of success in athletes. Strength training is a supportive action, a supportive process. It's supposed to support the swimming, biking and running.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be super good at squats or deadlifts.
No.
You want to be able to do deadlifts so they improve the strength of your lower back and your glutes and your hamstrings.
Yeah,
and so you can swim, bike and run better.
Exactly. Yeah. You get stronger tendons, ligaments and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. We're boxing off a lot of stuff today, aren't we, Andy? We're sort of, we could probably sit here and shake on that after that little thing at the velodrome that we now agree rather than being on opposite sides. So let's draw a line under that. Let's talk a little. You mentioned Precision Hydration in your business. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to explain a little bit more about Precision Hydration and how that works and what makes that slightly different. Because going back to that thing about consumer confusion, you do effervescent sports drink tablets.
Yeah.
You put them in the bottle, they dissolve, they give a little bit of flavouring and a concentration of electrolytes. But equally, I could buy those from Noon. I could buy them from OTE. I could buy them from High Five. So the consumer confusion is, what's the difference? What makes your product or your company different from a multitude of others that are out there?
The simple answer is that we do different concentrations of electrolytes because the big variable with people sweating is that people lose different amounts of salt. Now, over short durations or with low amounts of sweating going on, that makes not a lot of difference because you replace the electrolytes that you'd lose in short sessions or short events in your diet and the body balances itself out. When you get in the more extreme scenarios, when you're doing hours and hours on end of sweating, if you've got a very high sweat rate and a very high salt loss like I have, a standard sports drink is not strong enough in terms of electrolytes to replace what you're losing.
Okay, so let's say I'm doing a triathlon.
Yeah.
Noticing that I get a little bit of cramp, which, as we know, it might not be dehydration or lack of salt, it could be muscular fatigue as well. I notice that my tri suit has usually got really heavy duty sweat, salt deposits on it. How are you going to help me? What's the first process in me understanding actually what concentration of salt I'm actually sweating out?
Well, the easiest thing to do is on our website, we have a free online questionnaire, which you answer a few questions about what you do, whether you get cramps or not, whether you see salt stains on your kit. And we take that and we sort of use it to give you a guide on whether you might have a higher than average salt requirement or not. Then we give you a bit of a process to try, either using, some low strength products, mid strength products, high strength products to see how that benefits your performance. So it's a bit of a guided trial and error process. If people are way more keen to sort of really narrow it down, we can do sweat testing, but that requires visiting a location where that's available. You can find those through our website, but then what they can do or what we can do if you come and see us directly is actually take a sweat sample, analyze it, look at the salt concentration, then factor that in against sweat rate, against the type of activities you're doing and dial it in even more.
Right at the beginning, I mentioned that I'd done one of the very first testing procedures you'd done. So it's non-invasive, is it? It didn't actually require me to do any hard work or even get sweaty. I sat in a chair. You put this thing that looked like a watch, but on the backside of it, on the face that was next to the skin, it had a little hole, had a little coil inside, little tube.
Yeah.
And that slowly filled up with perspiration. I think you put a little chemical on the skin didn't you, to make the skin?
We stimulate the sweat glands.
Yeah.
And then put a collector on and collect that sweat up. And that stops the sweat from evaporating. It means you get a very clean, easy to work with sweat sample.
Okay, so the results of that, because then you put that little concentration of fluid into a machine and that tells you what concentration of salt I have in my sweat. Now, that's a non-active test. I'm sat down.
Yeah.
I'm in a room. I'm not sweating. I can imagine that people are thinking, well, surely my sweat concentration will differ then when I'm working out hard.
Yeah, a lot of people do think that. And whilst your sweat composition might fluctuate a little bit, it tends to stay. So the difference between sweat composition between two individuals can be huge. So you lose, I think it was, let's say it was around 500, 600 milligrams of sodium.
Probably less than that, but certainly
I remember
quite
it
low,
was very, very low. The average is about 950. I lose near 1800, 1900 milligrams. So I'm sort of two and a bit.
So you can't tell just by looking at you and me, you can't tell, can you? Because yours is more than twice what mine is.
And whilst when I'm exercising, maybe I might lose a little bit more one day or a little bit less. Fundamentally, my sweat composition is kind of high or very high in my case. Yours is low and will tend to always be relatively low. So what we liken it to is rather than measuring you and if fitting you for a tailored suit, you know, if that was your bespoke sports drink, what we're doing is putting you in a small, medium, large or extra large off the shelf.
Right. And that doesn't change then if I do a lot of training, get fitter. Does it change throughout the year? So if we were sat here now and doing a test in Boulder, as we've already mentioned, the weather's totally different to what it'll be in the UK in a few weeks when we get back, would there be a difference in that? That result?
Again, it can fluctuate a little bit. And, you know, there is some evidence for some people that acclimatization to a hotter climate will increase their sweat rate. Or that does happen to most people, increase your sweat rate. And they say that for some people, it reduces the sodium content of your sweat. Now, we've seen that with some people a bit, but not so much with others. So I think there's inter-individual variance. But fundamentally, I think that getting a handle on, you know, the rough amount of salt in your sweat at a point in time is a good starting point to figuring out where you're at. Now, we've repeat tested a lot of athletes over a lot of years, and typically in all sorts of circumstances, we don't see a lot of variation. So not enough variation to materially impact the kind of hydration recommendations they would have.
Going back to the consumer situation, somebody's going to go on to Wiggle and buy, some effervescent salt tablets and put them in their bottle and think they work. I've got a sense that you the way you're building your business is less towards the high-end retail but more towards customer care, actually having a relationship with those people where you look after them over a period of time, find a prescription that works for them. Maybe if they come back to you and say, right, well, now I was doing a standard distance triathlon in UK, but now I'm going to go and enter Marathon des Sables. So I'm going to spend 7 days in extremely hot conditions, exposed to that weather 24/7. So can you help me find a hydration prescription for that?
100%. We've increasingly invested in the business in customer support, customer service, getting to know our customers and athletes, talking to them on email, on the phone on a regular basis. We are plugging a gap which exists between people just buying a product off the shelf, reading the instruction on the back, the generic one size fits all use, doing that, or hiring a full on nutritionist to work with. You know, we are not nutritionists. We've got qualifications in nutrition, but we're not registered dietitians. What we are, quite a few of us are sports scientists, though we have a bank of experience, and we will answer emails with athletes on every single day about, I'm using this product in combination with this product. We'll be teaching them how to read a packet, because sometimes the way electrolyte or carbohydrate information on a packet is shown is confusing. It's per 100 grams and the serving size is 30 grams. And we're trying to get people educated in how to use these things, because the beauty of it is when someone finds the kind of recipe of calories, waters, salts that works for them in a endurance racing scenario, that will be massively beneficial to their performance. And for us, that's great because we're able to help people, because fundamentally I didn't have access to that type of information when I was an athlete, and that cost me some bad races basically. So we can help people, but also from a business point of view, then people then will presumably come back to us for more advice and more products in the future. So we genuinely want to plug that gap and not just be banging out as many units as we can through big box retailers and online. We want to be answering athletes' questions, and if our product suite is good and it fits someone's needs, then hopefully they'll buy it and they'll come back for more.
Listeners are going to be hearing this podcast at the beginning of October.
Yeah.
Now, that's just a couple of weeks before Kona.
Yeah.
So what we're chatting about has a lot of resonance for people who are going to be competing out there.
Yeah.
Or they might be doing Ironman Arizona. They might be going to Barcelona, which will be the week before. There's still some events for a lot of people where this will be very relevant. But also, quite a lot of the listeners will be coming towards the end of their season. Their focus now will be on winter training. let's just cover the people who are going to be competing in their final race of the season in some warmer conditions. One of the things that we're fond of saying as coaches is don't change anything too close to your race.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
So what advice would you have? But then equally, you talked about that guy who came to you for some advice. So what short bits of advice can you give for those athletes who are coming to those end-of-season races? Because you and I have been in Kona, and we've been at expos in races where you can see people going around and looking at the salt
tablets and then
going, oh, yeah, I need some of those. I've never used them before, but that guy says I'll need them on race day. So I'll go and buy them. So professional advice, please.
If you're racing somewhere hot in the next few weeks, the first thing to do is not overdrink in the days leading up to the event. Don't drink too much water and think that you need to be smashing water all the time, because that's one of the basic problems that we see.
So this idea about hyperhydration in advance is actually...
You just flush the electrolytes through your body, you wee a lot, spend a lot of time queuing for Portaloos.
But what about if you were hyperhydrating on something that had electrolytes in it? Does that not stay in the cells better?
If you use normal electrolyte drinks, they're not really strong enough to have a significant impact on that. And also your body self-corrects every 24 hours or so. So, you know, I would say if we talk specifically about Kona, if you're an athlete, you know, going to Kona, it's not a bad thing to salt your food a little bit more in the week leading up, because your electrolyte turnover will be high. You're going to sweat walking for a coffee, let alone doing a training session.
That's right. I mean, and that's why it's good to get to that race and probably do a bit of acclimatization before you go, because no matter how much you want to drink, it never seems to be enough in those first few days. You always seem to be behind the curve for the first 7 to 10 days, don't you?
So you're going to need a little bit more salt and a little bit more fluid in those days. Just don't go crazy with it. You know, just top up a bit more, but not so much.
You need to just be mindful, don't you?
Yeah. There's, rather than sort of go through all of the specifics of it now, there is, if you don't mind me doing this, there's a blog on our website called How to Start Hydrated. If people go to our website, precisionhydration.com, go to the blog, search for it. I think it's one of the most read ones. It's at the top. That gives you a really good idea of what to do in the last 48 hours before a big race in the heat.
Okay.
And essentially it tells you a bit of a preloading protocol to use the night before the morning of the race in order to top up your electrolytes and fluids in an effective way rather than just flushing them through your body. But I would say, the biggest piece of advice is, especially if you're coming from the UK or somewhere where it's really starting to get cool and you're going to be worried about hydration, like hydration is a huge factor in Kona, but you can easily overdo it as much as you can underdo it. So that would be the biggest consideration, I reckon.
Okay, well, we can put a link to that
blog
post on the show notes. What about the other athletes, the ones who are coming to the end of the season in the UK? As you said, it's going to be getting a little cooler there, sweating. Might not be the forefront of most people's minds, but you know, you go out on a cold day, you breathe out, you see that cloud of perspiration, expiration that's there. So you are still breathing out.
You're losing moisture.
So it's still something you need to think about in the winter.
It is, yeah. The reality is obviously your fluid and salt requirements do drop when you're sweating less. The exception in the winter has probably got more to do with if you suddenly start doing a lot of indoor training. You know, if you're doing a lot of indoor treadmill running, a lot of Zwifting or whatever your preferred indoor trainer of choice is, you know, you can get pretty hot and do a lot of sweating during that. Now, granted, if you're only doing hour long sessions, 90 minute sessions, maybe the impact of that is not going to be huge, but I know there will be some people these days, a lot more than it used to be actually, who will do 4 and 5 hour rides indoors if the weather's bad and that sort of thing. And they really do need to think about their hydration, because without that airflow, your core body temperature rises a lot more. And if you've got a heavy sweat rate, you know, what they can do actually with indoor training, it's quite a controlled environment. If you weigh yourself before and after a session and account for how much fluid you've drunk, you can have an idea of how much you've sweated. And that can be interesting and help you to get a handle on what the magnitude of your sweat loss is like.
Yeah, there's a couple of protocols that you need to adhere to, isn't there? Would you weigh yourself naked so you haven't got the absorbed sweat in your clothes? Because that won't show as much of a weight.
Just not if you're training in the gym, though.
No. that's going to be on my mind all day now. Yeah.
But again, it's not a plug, but we have a very detailed blog with that protocol and a spreadsheet you can put all your numbers into free on our website. So we can link to that as well. That one's called How to Measure Your Sweat Rate. And the key thing about it is I think people do this once or twice, but they need to do it 5, 6, 7, 8 times in different conditions and build up some average numbers in order to get meaningful results.
Great. So just tell people about the website again. Is it precisionhydration.com?
.com, yeah. The blog is the place to go for information. We've made it keyword searchable in the last few months, and that's been really helpful. If you can't find an answer to your question on there, email hello@precisionhydration.com, because we get back to all those emails within 24 hours, except on a Sunday when we're out training. And we would, you know, we can direct you to the best information or answer your question specifically. And we also post a fair bit on, you know, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram and those sort of things these days if people want to give us a follow.
Yeah, and you're at quite a lot of the races, aren't you? You'd be a lot of the cycling expos and that sort of stuff during the winter.
Yeah, we'll go to a few of the expos. And so it's especially in the UK, you can see us around. What we can also do, if you like, is set up a first time discount for your listeners to, if they wanted to, you know, do our online test and try the products.
Yeah.
So we'll set up a code, which will, what do you want the code to be?
Just call it Simon Ward.
Simon Ward. We'll just call it Simon Ward.
Simon Ward 20 or whatever discount you're giving.
Yeah. We'll put that out and we'll put that on the notes. Let's just put Simon Ward and we'll give you a discount. I think the one that we've got running at the moment is 15% off your first order from the website. So I'll put that, we'll make that up and it'll be valid all through till the end of the year.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Andy. It's been great chatting with you. It's a fantastic location. I can't promise that if you come back on, we'll be able to recreate this, but we can maybe get a picture up on the wall.
Exactly, yeah.
So we can sit and look at it.
It's been great to catch up. It's been a lot of fun. So we better get back in the conference soon.
Okay. Thanks very much. There you go, folks. That was Andy Blow, precisionhydration.com. All of those links that Andy mentioned will be on the show notes. So please do go and have a look. Educate yourself about appropriate replenishment of your salt requirements, and hopefully it will help you with a little improvement in your performance next year.
Cool.
Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.